in 3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach Podcast, episode 16. Grierson, this is enough podcasts now, 16, to start a bracket. And through this bracket, we can determine a winner. So what is our number one seed podcast? Can we make this the number one seed in our 16 episode podcast episode bracket?
You know, I'm just going to take it one game at a time, but I think we can do it. I think we got a good group of people here. We're all pulling in the same direction. I think if we just execute the way we're capable of, I think we can definitely do it.
So this is episode 60 of the Grierson Leach podcast. We remind you, as always, to please find us on Twitter at Grierson Leach, GRIERSONLEITCH. And subscribe to us on iTunes, find us on SoundCloud, see us at the New Republic, all those places. Of course, make sure when you come to iTunes to give us a nice review with the name of a movie that you would like us to talk about. If we pick your movie, and we will eventually get to all of them, we will talk about it on this podcast and read your review aloud. So the two reviews, we're going to do two reboot movies. The main focus of this week's podcast is Tim is leaving, about to go to Cannes. You're about to go to the Cannes Film Festival. We're going to talk a lot about that, some of the movies you're looking forward to. But also in our reboot section, we'll be talking about two movies. They come to us first from Arlene Turd Savant. I've actually become very tired of these casual turd academics. So it's good to know that there is.
Well, they're just a dime a dozen is the thing.
Exactly. So anyway, Arlene Turd Savant with the subject line smart as hell writes, I've enjoyed Will's writing since the Black Table days. Black Table is my old site that both Grierson and I wrote for. I feel like I grew up with him. Grierson and Leach's podcast and their approach to talking about movies is so refreshing. They're one of the few film podcasts that aren't slavishly devoted to geek culture. And thank God they don't go on for 3.5 unedited hours. At this point, we should probably pause. And thank, as always, our producer, Michaela, for making sure
that we do. Thank you, Michaela. Thank you.
We do not go on for 3.5 unedited hours. Anyway, the reviews are smart, funny, conversational, insightful, and very enjoyable. And Arlene Turd Savant requests Jonathan Demme's Married to the Mob. So we're going to be talking this week on one of our reboot movies is Married to the Mob. The second review comes from iMac Mark. Both are very, here's what iMac Mark says. Both are very knowledgeable on movies and offer candid and at times academic insight. That must be you, Christian. To movies that are reviewed, I enjoy how they have distinct personalities. That must be me. Looking to hear a reboot review of Casino Royale. And iMac Mark makes sure to note that we are talking about Daniel Craig's Casino Royale, not Woody Allen and Peter Sellers' Casino Royale, which is a very different movie indeed. So we're going to talk about those two movies in our reboot section. But the first thing we're going to do is we're going to talk about the Cannes Film Festival. Now, Grierson, how many Cannes Film Festival? You haven't left yet. You leave on, I don't know when people are going to listen to this. He leaves on Mother's Day as a gift every year to his mother. He leaves the country on Mother's Day.
Yes, I've gone three different times. This will be my third time going to Cannes. I have always left on Mother's Day. It always works out that Mother's Day is the weekend before.
It's the best thing you could do to your mother. So the Cannes Film Festival, you've been out there. This is your third year, not consecutive, right? You missed one year, but this is the third time going.
Yes, I went in 2013 and 2015, and I'm going again this year, yes.
What's different about Cannes for you than, say, Toronto, than, say, Sundance? Is there anything different about Cannes? Do you get to enjoy anything while you're there? What is about the Cannes Film Festival that always stands out for you?
As opposed to other film festivals, Cannes has new movies showing every single day. Most other festivals, whether it's Sundance or Toronto, let's say, they tend to front load their movies for the first 4 or 5 days of the festival. So much so that if your movie is premiering the first couple days of Sundance or Toronto, you sort of know that the festival likes your movie, wants to give it a big platform because that's when the media will be there at the festival. They're not going to stick around the entire time because eventually they stop showing new stuff and so people get out of town. Cannes doesn't work that way. Each day of the festival, there'll be at least one film in the official competition, and also there'll be other movies in other sections that are premiering each day. So you really can't go to Cannes for 5 days or 6 days. You really have to go for the entire 2 weeks to really see everything that's going to play. And there's no guarantee that the best movies or the films that the festival are most excited about are going to play at the very beginning. You feel like you really live in Cannes for 2 weeks. It really does feel like you are away from home and you're just kind of in the world of the festival. It's the biggest festival in the world. I would argue it's the most important festival in the world. But especially this year, there's kind of a sense of the big movies that we're excited about for the summer. Some of them are going to be playing at Cannes. And then there's a bunch of movies that are going to be opening in the fall this year that studios already feel like these are going to be the big Oscar contenders for us. And they use Cannes as kind of a launching pad. And even if you hate awards season and you hate the Oscars, what Cannes does is essentially say, these are the movies that are probably going to end up on top 10 lists. So there's a lot of expectation. There's a lot of a sense of, okay, we've gone through 4 months of kind of mediocre movies, not really kind of big, meaningful movies. Now the more kind of adult, good, grown-up, intelligent art house movies, they're going to start coming out now.
The Palme d'Or, am I pronouncing that correctly? It's French. I can never say things that are French.
Yeah, the Palme d'Or, yes, that's correct.
The Palme d'Or, I think particularly when you and I were first getting into movies, the Palme d'Or seemed to signify, like, Sex, Lies, and Videotape won the Palme d'Or.
Yeah.
Wild at Heart won the Palme d'Or. Barton Fink won the Palme d'Or. The Piano, Pulp Fiction, Secrets of Lies. You know, there a lot of these, like, movies that we really loved, independent movies, it felt like this, here comes the big one. This is a big deal. It really was a sign of the truly great movie. And I think we've had a few of those this century. I think Dancer in the Dark is probably the closest we've had. But now it feels like it's one of two things. It feels like it is a political statement, like Fahrenheit 9/11, for example, which is got to be one they'd love to have back. Or it is a movie... Like, the last year's movie was Deepan.
Deepan, yeah. Deepan, yeah.
Deepan, yes. Did you see that?
Yes, it's not one of my favorite films from Jacques Audier, which I believe I'm mispronouncing terribly, yeah. But he also did Rust and Bone and the movie that was on your top 10 that one year, Prisoner.
Prisoner, right. But I think it's funny because, you know, one of... Like the last few years, before that was Winter Sleep, which has even been released in the United States yet. Blue and the Worst Color was 3 years ago though, and that is you love that movie. I think it was very good as well. How much does that prize mean? Is this as important? Like when you were younger, it felt like, oh, this is the movie we got to be watching out for here, and it feels like the last two movies haven't even been released here.
Well, you know, it's funny because Winter Sleep did get released, but it got a pretty small release. And also another movie that falls into that category is Uncle Bunmei, Who Can See His Past. You know,
yes.
That's another movie that is a great movie, but just didn't get much of a release because these are, not only are they foreign language films, but they just have no stars in them, at least in terms of who Americans are interested in. I think that's also kind of the big problem. I think in some ways it's part of a larger problem in the U.S. in terms of how hard it is for these movies. They can find distributors, but getting them beyond L.A. and New York or even, say, Chicago, can be pretty tough. In terms of how the Palme d'Or is picked, of course, we have to remember it's a jury every year. And that jury... Right.
This year, headed up by George Miller from Mad Max.
Yeah, and you know, George Miller's doing it this year. And past year, Steven Spielberg headed the jury. The Coen brothers headed the jury. And at the festival, there's always a bit of conversation about... And to use this year as an example, what movie would a George Miller like the most? And it's a weird sort of thing because the jury president doesn't exactly get, it depends on how the jury is put together, but it's not as if the jury president gets final say on these things. The jury as a collective sort of makes these decisions. What's important to remember is that there's been a rule change. I forget how many years ago it was now, but you can't, the movie that will win Palme d'Or is not going to win actor or is not going to win actress. It used to be that you were eligible to win more than one award, and they decided to kind of spread the wealth around a little bit more. And there's also a second prize, which is the Grand Prix. There's a third prize, which is the jury prize. Then you also have Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and if they want to give any sort of special awards as well. And so they do kind of try to spread it out. And it's hard to know with a jury how often they want to, as you say, kind of send a statement out in terms of saying, we don't just like this movie, but we agree with its politics or what it's trying to say. And so in terms of its importance, I think when we were younger, we were at a phase with the Cannes Film Festivals where those movies were more important to U.S. audiences anyway. There was sort of like a certain amount of English language movies that won during that time. But a movie like Pulp Fiction, you're not seeing Pulp Fiction because it won the Palme d'Or. You're seeing that movie because you like Tarantino and the trailer was great. And, you know, I wrote about this back in the Yahoo days. That trailer for Pulp Fiction, I still remember vividly because it opens with this sort of frilly, kind of artsy-fartsy music. And it says, you know, something along the lines of Miramax Pictures, you know, is excited to announce the release of the movie that just won the Palme d'Or. And it sounds like, oh, it's one of those foreign pretentious movies. Oh, snore, snore. Then they cut to the Dick Dale music. Then you realize it's Pulp Fiction. And so in some ways, Miramax and Harvey Weinstein, because he's a marketing genius, got to have it both ways. And so in some ways, they were able to say, not only is this movie like really cool and bitchin', this foreign film festival thought it was really good too.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the movies at this particular film festival that you're particularly excited about. The first one, I look over, there are two types of movies, obviously. There are movies that are showing in competition and movies that are not showing in competition. So I feel like we should make that distinction a little bit. For example, the movie that's opening the film festival is Cafe Society, directed by Woody Allen. And anyone that listened to our last podcast know we've talked about that enough already. Yes. So we're going to move on from that. But other movies that will be premiering out there in the same way that Mad Max premiered out there last year are The BFG, which is Steven Spielberg and Roald Dahl, Money Monster, directed by Jodie Foster with George Clooney and Julia Roberts, and The Nice Guys with Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe, directed by Shane Black. Those are not in competition, but clearly all the reviews are going to filter back from there real fast, and we're going to get an idea, just like we did with Mad Max, of how of what those in the macro sense, what the Cannes Film Festival tells us, hey, is this movie going to be good or not? And in a lot of ways, because it's the first time everybody sees it, I feel like that's what people are going to be talking about in America almost immediately once those movies are screened.
Yeah, and I think there's also a bit of an expectation of, oh, well, the studios and the filmmakers behind those movies must be proud of them. And
they must feel good
about
it. Yeah,
I mean, right. With Woody Allen, of course, you know, he is a beloved figure at Cannes. And he always, if he has a movie available, he'll screen it at Cannes. It will always be out of competition because he always insists that he does not want to be part of the competition. But the Cafe Society aside, yeah, I think that the fact that all three of those movies are playing there must be enough of at least a sense that they're either happy enough with it or want the platform. Putting things out of competitions, at least a way to sort of showcase them without saying this is a masterpiece or this is a movie aspiring to be a masterpiece, which is really interesting because with BFG and with The Nice Guys, those movies feel more like crowd pleasers. Money Monster, I just don't have a positive feeling about that movie. It feels, frankly, it feels like a movie that Clooney would have directed, I have to say, because it feels like one of those movies where it's ripped from the headlines, but the headlines are kind of moldy at this point, and we sort of all know the point of it. And so I don't have a lot of warm expectations.
Okay, well, let's talk about the movies that are in competition, and particularly some movies that you said you were looking forward to, and some movies by directors that I think we've enjoyed the movies from the past. One of the movies I think we should probably just start off from the top, a filmmaker we've already talked about in this podcast with Midnight Special, is Jeff Nichols, who actually will end up having two movies released this year. Midnight Special was delayed, and Jeff Nichols, assuming that this, I think some of the early word has been good, he has a movie called Loving.
Yes, and that movie, Focus is going to put it out in, at least right now, early November. And they clearly feel like this has an award caliber prestige to it. It's based on a true story about an interracial couple in the late 1950s who got married and got arrested because of it. And because it is a Jeff Nichols movie, Michael Shannon is in it, though he is not the lead. Joel Edgerton and Ruth Negga are the two leads in this.
Who's on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Yes. If anyone watches Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., she was.
Yes, and so they play the interracial couple. And, you know, as I talked about in my New Republic review for Midnight Special, one of the things I think that really distinguishes Jeff Nichols as a filmmaker is that Loving will be his fifth film, and none of them have been like any of the other ones. They've all been sort of different genres, different worlds. And this movie, haven't seen it, but it feels like it is a prestige period drama based on a true story, relevant social issues that resonate with today's times. He's never done a movie like that. I'm very curious what he will do with that, because in other hands, I have to admit, I wouldn't be that excited about this movie. And I would think, oh, it's just going to be kind of polite and tasteful and slightly boring, and I will feel like I need to see it to be a good person, but I'm not going to get much out of it. Because it's Jeff Nichols, I'm much more curious. Yeah. And so I have huge hopes for that movie. In terms of movies I think are both highly anticipated, but also I think ones that audiences will be interested in, I think Loving is one of those ones that kind of fits the bill for both cases.
Also on the list is a film called Personal Shopper, which is from Olivier Assayas.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, who made Clouds of Sils Maria and Carlos, which is a movie I liked quite a bit. I liked actually both those movies, but I liked Carlos a little bit more. And this is featuring Kristen Stewart, who is kind of everywhere at this film festival.
Yeah, and one of the things that I talked about in my can preview for us is that I think that this is officially the year where no one should say, wait, Kristen Stewart's a good actress? I think that that snotty, dismissive attitude that people have had because she was in the Twilight movies and because of all of the excitement and obsession online about her and Robert Pattinson at the time. The work that she has done since the Twilight films, whether it's Still Alice, which I think she is incredibly underrated in. I think she is really, really tremendous in that movie. Or Clouds of Sils Maria, where she won the César, which is the French equivalent of the Oscar. She won Best Supporting Actress for that movie, becoming the first English language actress to ever win that award. I think that she's a pretty formidable actress, and she's going to be the star of this new movie called Personal Shopper. What's always interesting about Cannes is that you don't necessarily know a lot about the plot. They keep it kind of under wraps till the last minute. All we know is that it's a ghost story of some sort set in the world of Paris fashion. That's it. That's all that we've been told at this point. But I like Assayas's films. I like Kristen Stewart. I'm intrigued by this sort of this pairing of the two of them again. Another movie that I didn't feature in the preview I wrote was The Neon Demon. Since we talk about Only God Forgives, Refn is back, Winding Refn is back with his next movie. And that movie also seems like a strange, bizarre kind of mood piece that nobody knows much about. It has Elle Fanning in it. And sometimes you're just kind of going on faith. I feel like if you like the filmmaker and like their works before, you'll give it a try. And I think with Personal Shopper, Assayas's film, that is really the way you kind of go into it. And you just sort of hope, God, I hope this thing is good. The idea of discovery, I think it can, is one of his kind of great attributes.
Also this year, Jim Jarmusch, we've talked in this podcast before about Stranger in Paris. He has two movies. One is in competition and one isn't. One is a documentary about the Stooges.
Yes, and about Iggy Pop sort of specifically is the impression that I think it is. It's called Gimme Danger. And I think it's like more about Iggy Pop. I think there's definitely a Stooges element to it as well, yeah.
And the other film is Patterson,
which will be in the competition, and he's been in the competition several times. Last time was with Only Lovers Left Alive. And another thing that's, I think, worth pointing out for people who are interested in this type of minutia, when Cannes announces its slate of films that will play in its competition, it's a big announcement, and then like maybe say a week to maybe say 4 or 5 days afterwards, they'll also announce like another one that's going to play in the competition. Only Lovers Left Alive was like that for 2013. Now you might think that that means that the movie is terrible or something, like they just forgot about it or something, but what often happens, because Cannes is such a big deal for filmmakers, they're rushing to the last minute to get their movies done. And so the festival may not know if the director can deliver it in time. And so with Only Lovers Left Alive, Jarmusch got it done in time at the last minute, and it played in the competition. His new movie is called Patterson. It stars Adam Driver, who you might know from Star Wars The Force Awakens or other things like Girls or Inside Llewyn Davis. And he plays this kind of this mild-mannered bus driver. This is the plot description that we have of Patterson at this point. It's about Adam Driver playing a bus driver. And yet, it, you know, because you know Jarmusch is just one of those guys that, you know, when he makes a film, because he doesn't make a ton of them, it's kind of an event. It's kind of a big deal. And I think that for me, one of the reasons why I'm also really excited is I think Driver is one of those guys who's really coming to his own. I feel like Girls was the first time that most of us saw him, right? There was nothing before. Yeah, and he was great on Girls. And the stuff that he's done there, I think he's really funny in the Noah Baumbach film. I think he's, While We're Young, I think he's like the best part of that movie. I think he's really, really great in that. So I'm curious what he will do, because he's never necessarily had a major leading role. This will be kind of the first film for him like that. So I'm really, really curious about Patterson too.
All right, so give me two more movies you're excited about before you head out there.
I'm a big Andrea Arnold fan. She's a filmmaker who had done Fish Tank. Her last film was a adaptation of Wuthering Heights, which I thought was really underrated. This is her first movie set in America. It's called American Honey, and it stars Shia LaBeouf. And I forget the quote, and I wish I had it in front of me now, but when they made the announcement of the official competition, the people who run Cannes Film Festival said something about Shia LaBeouf being a prominent international figure or something like that. And I'm like, well, that's one way of describing him. I'm not doing justice to what that description was. But American Honey is another one of those movies where if you don't like the filmmaker, the plotline may not be something that would grab you. It's about a bunch of American kids traveling the country trying to find themselves. They have advertised this film as being sort of a statement about American youth, which can really go both ways. It can really be the type of thing where you think, oh boy, can't wait for one of those. But I have faith in Andrea Arnold. I think she's a great filmmaker, specifically because whether it's Fish Tank or her first feature film, Red Road, she makes movies that are about outsiders and people who are kind of lost, who tend to be on the younger side. So I think that she actually has an insight into that world more than just some pretentious American young filmmaker who wants to talk about, like, you know, the youth today, man, and what they're about. Riley Keough, who is tremendous in The Girlfriend Experience, the Stars TV series, she's also going to be in this movie. So I'm really, really curious about that.
All right. And one last thing. Paul Verhoeven has a movie in this.
His new movie is called Elle. If I remember correctly, this is his first French language film, just to prove he can just work in all different languages. He's also doing it in French. And it stars Isabelle Huppert as this executive who is attacked in her home by a criminal, some sort of shady individual. And the rest of the movie is her trying to track down this person and get revenge on this person. What's interesting about Elle being in the competition is that there might be an expectation from people who are listening to this to think that the movies in competition are more meaningful, thought-provoking, kind of chin-stroking intellectual exercises, perhaps, because it's the Cannes Film Festival and it's an international festival. And you definitely have movies that have, let's say, maybe higher artistic aspirations. But you also have straight-up genre movies. I could not believe this until I actually wrote the preview that I did for The New Republic. Basic Instinct played in the official competition.
That's
amazing, I have to say. Like, to actually, like, because the theaters there are so incredible, they're gorgeous, big screens. To see Basic Instinct for the first time with a crowd like that would have been amazing. I can't even imagine what that was like.
Didn't Ebert write about seeing Godzilla there? Ebert has like a famous review of Godzilla. I'll look it up while you're talking about that.
You will see these kind of interesting outliers. And so the fact that Elle sort of sounds like a kinky, twisted, dark revenge thriller, incredibly curious to check it out. I mean, you know, I keep saying this, kind of getting around to this, but like, what's fun about Cannes is there's these great filmmakers who have these amazing reputations, And who knows what's going to happen with their next movie. If it's going to be a disaster or something really, really amazing. And you just kind of go into these things thinking, well, we'll find out. And because each day is a new film, each day sort of feels like another fun roll of the dice.
Well, we will close out our canon discussion with the first paragraph of Roger Ebert's review of Godzilla on May 26, 1998, Dateline Cannes, France. Going to see Godzilla at the Palais of the Cannes Film Festival is like attending a satanic ritual in St. Peter's Basilica. It's a rebuke to the faith that the building represents. Cannes touchingly adheres to a belief that film can be intelligent, moving, and grand. Godzilla is a big, ugly, ungainly device to give teenagers the impression they are seeing a movie. It was the festival's closing film, coming at the end like the horses in a parade, perhaps for the same reason. All right, Grierson, now it's time for our reboot section. Let's start off with Married to the Mob.
Everybody loves Angela, but she's married to the mob.
I want a divorce!
It's checkout time, Frankie.
Frank! I'm coming with you!
Yes, from 1988, the Jonathan Demme movie starring Matthew Modine and Michelle Pfeiffer. Just to start off, I have to say, I had never seen Married to the Mob. Had you seen it before, Will? Had you?
I don't remember seeing it, but then watching it, there were times I'm like, oh, I remember this. I remember this. So, but I had seen some section of it, but I think this is the first time I'd ever actually sit down and consciously concentrated to watch on it.
Michelle Pfeiffer plays a wife of a mob hitman, played by a very young Alec Baldwin. And she's not entirely thrilled with his line of work and by extension, the life that she has to live because of him. When he is killed, assassinated, executed.
In the first 10 minutes of the movie, so don't worry.
So when her husband is killed, she starts to think about maybe starting a new life. But the mob boss, played by Academy Award nominated actor in this performance, Dean Stockwell, which was a shock to me when I looked this up. Dean Stockwell plays the mob boss. He doesn't want her to leave the life. And in fact, he has designs on this young lady himself. In the same time, she is being pursued by a federal agent played by Matthew Modine, who is working with Oliver Platt, a very young looking Oliver Platt as well. And Matthew Modine goes undercover and kind of infiltrates her life, and a romance begins to blossom. If my description of this movie sounds slightly like I don't care, I will confess, Jonathan Demme is an interesting filmmaker for me. I guess that's probably the best way to start. My favorite film of his, and it's by a large, large margin, is actually Stop Making Sense, his 1984 Talking Heads concert movie, which I, in complete seriousness, considered to be one of the great movies that has ever been made. I think it is an amazing, amazing concert film and a real achievement. And, you know,
And the music of this movie is from David Byrne.
It sounds nothing like Talking Heads, by the way.
I think if the Talking Heads music sounded like this, I'm not sure the Talking Heads would have become that popular.
Yes. And he dives into a certain kind of American-ness, I guess, for lack of a better way of describing it, that he kind of loves the quirky, the offbeat in his fiction films, especially in his comedies, obviously. I mean, Silence of the Lambs in Philadelphia don't fall into this category. But even like his remake of the Denzel Washington, the Manchurian Candidate, is a type of movie that it doesn't kind of come at it at a straight angle.
Well, Rachel Getting Married would be a good
There's always a bit of a weirdness. And that weirdness tends to be really intriguing in his movies. I watched it kind of in a fog, I have to say, because I kept thinking, boy, this is really, really broad and not in a way that was really deeply appealing. I get, obviously, the sense that it's a farce in certain ways, but it feels, you know, Will and I are people who grew up in the 1980s. I don't feel a certain nostalgia for certain elements of the 1980s, where I know that people of my age definitely do. And this is like almost right in the bullseye of the type of 80s movie that I don't have any particular warmth or nostalgia for, because to me, it's so broad and so silly that it feels so weightless that it was hard for me to, I mean, I think Michelle Pfeiffer is really fun in it. I think Matthew Modine is kind of a disaster in it. And it is, yeah. And that's why, and this one especially was really interesting to go back and read reviews of, to kind of get a sense of how people felt at the time about Matthew Modine's performance and Michelle Pfeiffer's performance. Because I kept thinking, was this the movie that Goodfellas came on the planet to destroy? Because, like, you know, Goodfellas comes out 2 years later. And that movie feels so... Listen, I don't have a mob background, so I can't speak from personal experience, but that movie feels so lived in and observed in such a beautiful way. And listen, Married to the Mob is not pretending to be accurate in any sort of sense, but it just feels so silly and dumb in a way that just feels flip, that kind of from moment one, I was thrown out of the movie and kept trying to fight back into it and could never really... click.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know what? You know, it's funny. Tim and I, we've talked about this before. We went to high school together. Our senior musical was Guys and Dolls, and Tim got Nathan Detroit because Tim can sing and he's a better actor than I am, and I got Big Julie because I can't sing and I'm not as good an actor as Grierson is. And this feels like it feels. Like at the depth of understanding about the mob as Guys and Dolls, if maybe even a little bit.
Yeah,
less.
But Guys and Dolls has great songs and it's really funny. Where this is kind of like,
and it's not. It's also not like instantly and immediately recognizable as an '80s movie. Silence of the Lambs came out 3 years after this. Like, that's insane. Like clearly. Like, listen, he made other movies in the 80s. Something Wild. Have you ever seen Something Wild?
I was just going to say, that's actually the next one I now need to see, because I thought retroactively, oh, I actually heard the good things about Something Wild. Am I not going to like that either? Right. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, though. It's like Swing Shift is good. Melvin and Howard is a movie he made in the 80s. Like, it feels like he was experimenting to try to do something mainstream while still trying to have a little bit of his weirdness in it, and he hadn't figured out the formula.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. As always, you know, reading Roger Ebert's review afterwards, it very much validated my feelings, though he actually gave it a thumbs up. That his review of it was, yeah, it seems like Demme's trying to do something a little more mainstream and accessible. And whatever impact it might have had at the time, or Dean Stockwell was nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
And he's not very good at.
Yeah, it's the thing is, it's not even like necessarily that it's a bad performance. It just feels like what does not hurt the movie or does not help the movie in 2016 is that whether it's Goodfellas or The Sopranos, I think there's more of a sense of you kind of have to come correct with if you're going to do this type of thing, because if you just do it like really broad, people will just dismiss it out of hand as being stupid.
Yeah, and also those, like, not only are those movie and that TV show, like, much more real, they're also a lot funnier.
Yes.
Like, both, yeah. Like, in all seriousness, like, you know, I mean, those movies, obviously, and Sopranos and Goodfellas go to very dark places, but they're also very funny, and they also grow out of an actual understanding. This feels like he was trying to make a farce and never quite gets right. You know who actually does get the tone? I think Michelle Pfeiffer's good in this, but the person that gets the tone right is actually Alec Baldwin.
Yes.
I feel like the movie loses a ton of steam the minute that he exits the movie. He actually seems – you also forget just how much fun young Alec Baldwin was and how he had this sort of danger electricity to him that I think gets forgotten a little bit.
Yes, I think that's a good point. But at the same time, he's also kind of dopey and fun at the same time. Yeah, like right. He also hits the thing of being – a satiric character or kind of a dopey character at the same time, where everybody else just, not everybody, but most of them just seem kind of dumb. It needs to be said again, as somebody who likes Matthew Modine quite a lot normally in his performances, this is just one of those bad choices.
It's the wrong choice.
So I speaking for Will, or maybe not, I apologize to our very nice reviewer or listener who gave us a very nice review, and now we're trashing the movie that you asked us to review. Maybe you don't like Married to the Mob either, though. Maybe you're trying to set us up to see like our integrity and testing our integrity.
I have to say, I felt the same. I was like, wow, people liked this, huh? Okay.
Now, I was actually kind of hoping that you liked it so you could explain it to me. I'm going to be honest. There's a little part of me like, well, maybe Will will like can like clue me in on something that I'm just like totally missing. But no, there was...
That not happening. All right, so now we go to Casino Royale.
It doesn't bother you, killing those people?
Well, I wouldn't be very good at my job if it did. Hot old girl, melted your cold heart yet?
James, get the girl out.
You're not going to let me in there. You've got your armor back on.
I have no armor left. You've stripped it from me.
Yes, from 2006. This movie is 10 years old. And it's a two-time reboot star, Daniel Craig, who we talked about for Girl with a Dragon Tattoo somewhat recently. This was Daniel Craig's first turn as James Bond, directed by Martin Campbell, who had directed GoldenEye. He had done a James Bond movie before. What was interesting when I was going back to watch this, by the way, if you have a cable subscription, wait a half an hour. This movie is probably going to be on at some point, by the way. It is whether it's the Sci-Fi Network, BBC, America, wherever it is, you will find this movie somewhere. I was actually, while rewatching it, I was actually trying to remember what my expectations were going into this. I think I knew that they were going in a darker direction, that they were rebooting the character to a certain extent. I think I knew that going in. I was vaguely familiar with Daniel Craig, but not someone who is an aficionado of Mr. Craig. This movie almost made my top 10 at the time. It was actually number 11, just barely missed my top 10. This is still my favorite of the Daniel Craig James Bond movies. I know there are a lot of Skyfall.
I'm a Skyfall guy.
I know there are a lot of Skyfall fans. And I actually, I watched the second half of this. My wife was in the room and she and I are both big fans of this movie. And because my wife is endlessly patient with me when I say things over and over again, when this movie ended, I said to her something I say all the time when it comes to this movies. I say, this movie has Eva Green in it. The other James Bond movies don't. Therefore, it's the best of the Daniel Craig movies. This is the only James Bond movie where that love story, I think, deeply matters. And there's a real emotional undercurrent. And what happens to those two characters and what happens to her, there is a real sense of, oh, you know, we talked about, you know, in terms of Captain America Civil War, you know, on that podcast, about how there's an attempt at emotional resonance, but you don't really walk away with it from that movie thinking about those characters. This movie, I still remember walking away feeling like, wow, James Bond has actually gone through something. And I've seen a lot of James Bond movies, but this is the first one where I really felt like a punch to the gut in terms of what happens to that character and kind of what the cost is of what he becomes by the end of that movie. For people who haven't seen it or don't remember it, in this movie, Daniel Craig plays James Bond, who has just become part of the 00 unit. Is the 00 unit? What's the name of the organization?
The MI6.
Yes, MI6. And he's gotten his official license to kill status. And he's going on one of his first big missions. I will confess that, like a lot of the James Bond movies, the plot is not something I care about very deeply. But not just beyond, like, these are the bad guys. He has to defeat the bad guys. Eva Green plays the woman who's going to be working alongside him. They initially don't get along. Spoiler alert, they do fall in love, because who could not fall in love with James Bond? But more importantly, who could not be seduced by the Eva Green character? Because among James Bond love interests, I think that she is the best drawn character. I think she's the smartest character. I think that she pushes James Bond in a way that none of his other love interests really have. This was written by several different people, but the one person I always have to mention, because we rip on him a lot in terms of his other movies, is Paul Haggis. I don't have any proof behind this, but I actually think that in some ways Paul Haggis is the most important of the screenwriters in this movie, because I have a sneaking suspicion that he did a lot of the character stuff. Because I mean, my sense is that even when his movies don't work, he thinks about, you know, character things are kind of a big deal for him. And just that exchange that Daniel Craig and Eva Green have on the train together is so flirtatious and sexy, but also kind of smart and establishes those two characters. This was also the movie that I think for a lot of people, that's how they learned about Mads Mikkelsen, which is now sort of funny to think about because of Hannibal and these other things that he's been in. This was the movie, they think, for a lot of people that where they went, oh, this guy is really intense and awesome and creepy and really cool as a bad guy. But this was the beginning of the dark reboot, incredibly influenced by both Jason Bourne and Batman to a certain extent. Right. That is, anyway, I will now cede the floor to the man from Athens, Georgia.
Thank you. Not from Athens, Georgia, in Athens, Georgia, and but not of, though I love it here. Anyway, what I find curious to look at this movie, because I think it very much holds up. I think that Mads Mikkelsen is a great bad guy. Everything you say about Eva Green is exactly right. You know, one of the things I really like about this is that James Bond screws up sometimes.
Yes.
James Bond screws up sometimes, that he's still kind of getting the feel of this. Like, I think that was almost a happy accident or a good idea combined with a happy accident that his first movie as James Bond is a new James Bond, in that, like, this is the beginning. They finally got the rights to the first James Bond book, so they're able to kind of restart it in the same way that Batman, particularly Batman Begins. I feel like Batman Begins is a closer spiritual cousin than even the Jason Bourne movie. Like, this, like, Batman Begins is a, you know this character, but we're starting it over. One thing I do kind of, I find interesting though, to look at this years later, is there's been four Daniel Craig James Bond movies. I think two have been really good, this and Skyfall, and two have not been very good. I think Quantum of Solace is barely even written. It was during the writer's strike. It's clearly just kind of hanging together by a thread. So I almost give them a pass on that one. But Spectre, I don't think is very good either. And for a variety of reasons, kind of a dumb villain. But one of the main reasons that Spectre doesn't work is it begins to feel like a Bond movie again.
Yes, I totally agree. Yes.
And one of the things that's so exciting about this is, in the same way that Batman Begins is very exciting, is you forget that this is one of the most iconic characters in all of popular culture, and you just kind of accept it as being built from the ground up in this entirely new character. And that is, to be able to pull that off with, it was crazy enough that they pulled off with Batman, to pull it off with James Bond, who is, like, you know, I mean, there's never even been a lot of variation in James Bond. So to do that is incredibly impressive. But also, you know, it brings into mind that how it doesn't take very long once you reboot a character for them to start feeling like the gravity pulls them back to being that character.
Yes.
Again.
I
feel like, Spectre is a great example of that. Like, Spectre, he's back. Like this movie is full of, like, little winks. He doesn't care how you make his martini. The way he says Bond, James Bond, is actually kind of a clever, fun way to do it. But the problem is, you can do those things once. Now we're starting to already lose the Daniel Craig Bond in Spectre, because he's just a guy with cool cars that gets girls.
Yeah.
And I think it's watching Casino Royale again. It's just reminding of how kind of amazing that reinvention really was.
Yeah, and also I think this movie's director is so interesting, because Martin Campbell,
he'd actually done a bad Bond movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, because Goldeneye was during that period where you kind of went, well, it's not that bad. And Martin Campbell, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, is not the type of director where you think, wow, what a vision. I mean, the movie that he made after this, one of the movies he made after this, was Green Lantern.
Right. You know, which I like. Remember, I like that movie. I do. I like that movie.
One of the great things about this podcast on a weekly basis is it allows one of us to admit, whether it's whether it's Battleship for me or Green Lantern, it's great. I will say, just as a quick side note, one of the things I do love about our relationship, just in general, we have these movies that even we are amazed by ourselves that we actually like them. God help us, we like them. But again, I think it was just, there was just one smart decision after another. I think it was just, whether it was the casting or the writing or the directing, these action sequences I think are just tremendous. I think that opening sequence, the prologue, if you will, is really, really great. The chase sequence at the beginning is really terrific. It moves along. And also, another thing I want to say to this movie's benefit, it's, you know, we've talked about this, most action movies now are 2.5 hours. You just can't get away from that. That's the length they're going to be. This movie, I think, though, actually has, when it has its big, what we think is the ending, it's sort of like extended denouement, what happens after he gets away with the girl at the end, I think is really, really great. I think that that last scene, though it's kind of cool and awesome that James Bond, you know, gets the guy, essentially gets the guy who's behind the whole thing and kills him, I've always walked away from this movie thinking, yeah, but he sure has lost a lot. And I agree that this movie plays better into Skyfall. The only thing that Quantum of Solace has going for it, and that movie I think is terrible, like outright awful, is that movie at least seems to be haunted by the fact, or it's haunted by the fact that Eva Green is gone and James Bond can't get over her. That's the only thing that movie I think that kind of works. Everything else, you know, terrible bad guy, uninteresting love interest, all of that stuff. Skyfall works better as a continuation. I agree.
He's done, right? Like, is Craig done with these now? He's got to be.
Well, you know, he keeps talking about, after his famous, like, slit his wrist comments after, right, during the promotion for Spectre, it seems like no one is very happy. Though Spectre made a ton of money, it seems like nobody's happy. Like, Sam Mendes wasn't happy with that movie, and Daniel Craig doesn't sound like he was entirely happy with it. So it's hard to know. And there's already been, like, talk about, or is someone finally going to let Elba, as I was telling somebody the other day, Elba is going to be the greatest James Bond who was never James Bond.
Right, at this point,
it'd probably be just as well that he would never be James Bond, because then it's like people always wonder what it would have been like. And he doesn't have to actually make one of these movies and have people not like him in it. So I don't know. It just definitely seems like the franchise at this point is kind of in limbo.
Yeah, because Spectre was a bummer, man. Spectre was a real bummer.
Great opening sequence, but after that, that, it's like, oh no.
It's what they get for rejecting the Radiohead song, man.
it's the Radiohead curse, yes.
Exactly. But all right. Well, so that is Casino Royale. Grierson, you are about to go.
Yes.
You're about to leave us on Mother's Day. You're going to be gone for 2 weeks.
That is correct. Yes,
we're still, but you come heck or high liquid, you are going to do this podcast for the next 2 weeks.
That is my hope. Yes, I am.
That's your intention.
That's my intention. Yes,
but the movies that we're probably going to talk about are The Lobster, which is the new film from, say the guy's name, please.
Don't make me have to say it. From the fantastic Greek filmmaker who made Dogtooth and Alps.
Yes, Dogtooth. We both love, I like Alps and I love Dogtooth. So I am very, very excited about that movie. Also, we are probably going to talk about Money Monster, which is a movie directed by Jodie Foster, starring George Clooney and Julia Roberts. And our reboot segment, because we always want to make sure to let you know, like we did last week, that you can watch the reboot movie we're selecting along with us, is The King of Comedy from 1982, directed by Martin Scorsese, starring Robert De Niro, before he became the comedy god that he is now. To Jerry Lewis.
Cough.
And Sandra Bernhard. Sandra Bernhard. And that is The King of Comedy. So that is our reboot movie next week. So we'll be talking about that. From France. You will be in France, Grierson.
Yes. And by the way, King of Comedy actually played at the Cannes Film Festival. I just realized that. So.
All right, Chris. Well, have a wonderful time out there. Have a safe trip. I am envious that you're out there. Someday I'd like to be able to go. But have a wonderful time. Be safe. Good luck with everything.
I'll talk to everyone soon.
We'll see you next week.
All right, bye.